Minutes from January 17th. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are approved. Now we have an overview this morning scheduled for the Legislative Auditor's Office. Yeah, we're trying to keep the audience in the dark here today. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Nobles, and introduce yourself for the tape, and you can proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Jim Nobles. I'm the Legislative Auditor, and with me at the table is Chris Boozy, who is the Deputy Legislative Auditor for the Financial Audit Division, and Judy Randall, who is Deputy Legislative Auditor for the Program Evaluation Division. And Mr. Chairman and members, we are delighted to be with you today. This is really a committee that we feel very, very comfortable with. We've been before many times. Many of you are familiar with us, but I do see some new faces. So we will try to give you an overview of who we are, what we do, and why we do it. So we do have a packet for you, and let me just, before I start with the slides, let me just point you to this document in your packet. And it's just a quick profile. Gives you a little more information about the office. We're going to cover some of this in the slides, but just in case you want a little bit more information, feel free to use this as a reference point. It may raise some questions, as you see. Talk a little bit about the office overall, the two divisions, and then on page 7, there's the organization chart. Pretty simple, straightforward organization. On the next page, a very high-level look at our financial situation, which is very much within the jurisdiction of this committee, although we have in recent years received some additional appropriations from some of the other committees that wanted us to do some special audits. What I really want you to take a look at, though, and take with you and use in the future, and that is starting on page 9, and that's the law that set up the Office of the Legislative Auditor. And I emphasize that because you created us. Well, people who sat in your seats before. In 1973, I don't know if any of you were here then. I actually was. Staffing the House Governmental Operations Committee. And it was very important to the legislature that the Office of the Legislative Auditor, the Legislative Audit Commission, be given a legal mandate, a charter. And so everything we do, and frankly, everything we don't do, is defined by what you've put in the law. And we'll talk a little bit about that. But at some point, you know, if you have any questions about what we do, why we do it, how we do it, I'll probably be referring to the law. I actually carry it around with me everywhere I go. It's in this notebook. I don't leave home without it because questions come up. Do we have the authority to do X, Y, Z? And if it's not in here, we don't. So to start with the slides, and I think somebody's going to help me move those along because I can't see them. I think the most important thing for us is our mission. Now, I know that you can go in a lot of stores, a lot of organizations, and they have a nice mission statement on the wall. Well, ours is on the wall. If you walk into the Office of Legislative Auditor, it's there right at the front door in the lobby. But more than being on the wall, it is what we do every day. It's who we are. It's what we feel when we're doing our work. We're there as agents of legislative oversight and accountability every day, every hour, every month of the week. We are digging deep into the agencies and organizations that you fund and create to find out how they're spending money. We also, along the way, would also like to contribute to the improvement of state government. So we want to try to look at programs and activities and see if they're cost-effective, and if we find problems, to make recommendations. That doesn't always mean that we'll recommend doing things cheaper, though sometimes we will. But we will often try to find ways we can do things better, because every program that we're spending money on ought to achieve results. the kinds of results that you and the public expect. So if you turn the page, I will now refer back to the law and what you've given us as jurisdiction. And it is very large. We are the auditor of state government, but even more than that. We start, and most of our focus is on auditing organizations within the executive branch. Everything from the governor's office, which we do audit, all the way down to the Board of Cosmetology. And no offense to the Board of Cosmetology, referencing them at the bottom, I'm sure they do great work. It's just to illustrate there are hundreds of organizations in the executive branch. And any of them, all of them, we have jurisdiction to audit, evaluate, and investigate. We also, and this is something that sometimes people don't realize, we also have jurisdiction to audit within the judicial branch. Now, we don't go in and question the judgment of judges, but we do look at how they spend money, too, because you appropriate that as well, and it's a pretty significant amount. We also have jurisdiction at the University of Minnesota and at Minnesota State. We don't do a lot of work there. We have in the past. But the University of Minnesota has created a very strong and, we think, quite independent internal audit office that reports to the Board of Regents. We work closely with them, and we trust a lot of the work we do. But every once in a while, you want us to go over to the university and do some work, and we do. We just, a couple of months ago, issued a report on a special review we did at the University of Minnesota on whether or not their use of fetal tissue was compliant with the law. Again, the same is true with MNSCU. MNSCU has established a very strong internal audit organization, has a very strong governance structure, but we'll go over there when we need to. Then there are the metropolitan agencies. We have jurisdiction over those. We also have jurisdiction to go into nonprofit organizations that receive state money. And nonprofit organizations receive a lot of state money. This really increased with the legacy amendment. A lot of legacy money goes to nonprofit organizations, and we can go in and audit their use of that money and hold them accountable to the law, to the grant agreements, and all the other legal requirements that are imposed upon them. And then there's a lot of other stuff. Contracts, anywhere money goes. Even if it is a contractual relationship that the state has had with a private contractor, and there's some issues about how that money was spent, we can look at that as well. So now, looking at the slide down from that authority, what authority do we have when we're doing all of these audits and evaluations and special reviews? Well, again, in the law, you have given us very strong authority. You have said to agencies and all the organizations, public and private, that receive public money, that they have to cooperate with us. And they have to provide us with all documents and data, regardless of classification. And that's one of the ways in which our arm extends deeper into the operations of state government than this committee or other committees can. Because what you will find is that there are some things that go on in state government. And if you have a commissioner in front of you and you want to know things about how that money has been spent and how that program is operated, they will tell you, we cannot share that information with you. They have to share it with us. That's what the law requires. Now, we are also bound by the Government Data Practices Act, and we cannot disclose not public information. So when we see private confidential information, we see it for drawing conclusions, creating findings and recommendations. But we, too, have to maintain that as not public. And we, frankly, see a lot of not public information. You also have given us the authority to protect sources. And I just jumped past subpoenas, and we'll get back to that. But it's very important that in the law we can protect the identity of sources. We deal a lot with sources, with whistleblowers who come forth and give us information. We also seek information from people who will be reluctant to provide it to us if we do not protect their identity. We are currently, for example, conducting a special review of allegations that money from the state's child care assistance program is being used to fund terrorism. That has taken us deep into the world of law enforcement, and we have received a good deal of information from law enforcement to form our findings about that issue, but we cannot disclose what we have found, and they have told us. So if people are reluctant to cooperate, and generally they're not, particularly if they fall under the provision that requires them to cooperate because they receive public money, they're a state employee, a state official. But if they don't cooperate, we can and have on occasion issued subpoenas. I did recently and had quite a stir over that. Let me just say a word about it, and you may ask questions after we finish up. We're reluctant to issue a subpoena. We much prefer that people cooperate, and that is certainly the what we put forward. We ask them to provide us with the information, and we give them a reasonable amount of time, typically 10 days, 2 weeks. If the data and documents are not forthcoming, we will consider a subpoena. We issue subpoenas for a variety of reasons. Again, sometimes people are reluctant to come forth and give us testimony, and so we will issue for that purpose, but we also will issue it for obtaining documents, and we can come back to that issue if you want. Now, some of you may be asking, who is this guy? And how did he get here? I'm appointed by the Legislative Audit Commission. And you see on the slide who your colleagues are who are on the Legislative Audit Commission. It's bipartisan. It's bicameral. Equal number of senators and representatives and an equal number of Republicans and Democrats. Looking around the room, Representative Quam, looks like you hold up the membership of the Legislative Audit Commission in this group. And we really appreciate his work on the commission. The commission is very important in many ways. First of all, they do appoint the legislative auditor. I'm appointed for a six-year term. I'm currently at the end of my six-year term. So they're important for that as well. But they also choose, and Judy Randall is going to talk about their involvement in choosing our evaluation topics. But they are the people that report to us. We are accountable to the Legislative Audit Commission. But what they tell us to do, and we do this, is that we work a lot with the committees of jurisdiction. The Legislative Audit Commission is not trying to usurp your jurisdiction or the Human Service Committee jurisdiction. If they tell us to do an evaluation of whatever it is, of a transportation issue, a human service issue, they want us to come to that committee of jurisdiction. So if we look at MNLARS or MNIT, we will be before this committee, I'm sure, talking about MNIT, because I know that's going to be a big item on your agenda this year. So even though we work closely with the Legislative Audit Commission, and they, as I said, will direct us to do an evaluation, I think it's important to know, and I think many of you probably understand this from your business backgrounds or government backgrounds, that one of the cornerstones of being an auditor is independence. We don't have credibility if we are not independent. We also don't have credibility if we don't do good work. But we have to start with a foundation of independence. How do we achieve that? Well, first of all, again, as I said, I'm appointed for a six-year term, and that gives the organization a degree of independence. But also, once we are told we should go off and evaluate or investigate a program or an activity, that becomes our work alone. We try to scope it and design it so that it will answer legislative questions, but the findings, the recommendations are ours and ours alone. Members of the Legislative Audit Commission do not see the report in draft. They don't see a public report until it's made public to everybody. So if you don't like some of our reports, and I look around the room, and I'm sure that some of you haven't, and I look around the room, and I think some of you have, but hold us accountable. We are responsible for every sentence, every word that is in our reports. And our work products, we produce audits. We audit the state's financial statements. Mr. Boozy is going to talk about that. We do control compliance audits. We also have a unit within Mr. Boozy's division that looks at IT, particularly cybersecurity issues. Ms. Randall's going to talk about our work and our products on program evaluation. And then we do investigations on an ad hoc basis and special reviews. And again, that is something we're authorized and responsible to do in the law. They typically involve allegations of the misuse of public resources, and I'm usually involved directly in those. Our organization is fairly straightforward and simple. We have 60 staff. Many of them are CPAs. Many of them are certified fraud examiners. We have a multidisciplinary team of people in our program evaluation division. We have a legal counsel, and we're divided into these two divisions, and that is all funded by mostly you, and you'll see our budget on the next slide. As I said, most of our money comes through you and the general fund, and almost all of that money is used for salaries, 92%. We pay rent, unlike some other legislative offices that occupy space in this room. We're in the Centennial Building, and so we pay rent. That's a significant part of our budget. It's about 4%. And then we have 4% for other operating costs. So, Mr. Chairman, with that, if I could turn to Mr. Boozy to give you a brief overview of the Financial Audit Division.
Thank you. Go ahead with your testimony. Identify yourself for the tape.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to testify this morning. My name is Christopher Boozy. I'm the Deputy Legislative Auditor for the Minnesota Legislative Auditor's Office. Mr. Chair and committee members, there's some distinct differences between the Financial Audit Division and the Program Evaluation Division, which Ms. Randall leads, but we work together collaboratively on many projects. For the most part, the Financial Audit Division addresses financial audits with financial-related questions. For example, we look to make sure that government resources are used appropriately, that agencies have strong fiscal controls. But one of the things that we also do in our audits is that every pool of money that we look at in state government came from some legal source. We also make sure that money is used for authorized purposes as well. The makeup of our team, we have about 35 members of our team that have the deep financial expertise. You'll find a lot of certified public accountants on our team. You'll also find a lot of certified fraud examiners as well. But we do have two members of our staff with deep expertise in IT, and those are the two that are doing our information technology audit work. One of the things that's different about the program evaluation and the financial audit divisions is that the vast majority of the work that my division does is required in state law. In fact, about two-thirds of the work you will find rooted in statute or in law. But we do have about a third of our pool of resources that's available for what we call discretionary work. And I'll talk about the required and discretionary work on the next couple slides. So first of all, starting with the required work, on the slide, you'll see some examples of the work products that we're in the process of completing or have completed over the last few months. The left two boxes represent the vast majority of the work that's done by the Financial Audit Division, and that's the audit of the state of Minnesota's financial statements and the audit of all the federal programs that the state of Minnesota participates in. If you get a chance to go out and look at the state of Minnesota's financial statements, we issue the opinion on the financial statements. It's a book that's about 2 inches thick, so I'd recommend that you don't print it and carry it away. But you can go out on the state's website, on MMB's website, and you can get a copy of the state's financial statements. For those of you that are familiar with financial statements for private sector entities, one of the things that's interesting, and in fact I think it's elegant about government financial reporting, is you can see an enterprise-wide view of the government. That's everything all wrapped up into top-level financial statements. You can see all the revenues, the expenditures, all the assets, liabilities, and the fund balance for the government as a whole all wrapped up in a top-level set of financial statements, very much like you'd find in a private sector corporation. However, one of the things that's also interesting about government financial reports is that we also have a second set of statements where you can look at every single fund of the government, and there's hundreds of them, and you can actually see that same information broken down into individual funds. So in that report, you can go out there and you can see the $80 billion of investments that my team audits and makes sure are properly valued as part of the financial reporting. But you can also go down, if you're interested in environmental issues, you can go down and you can see what happened within the Game and Fish Fund, or you can see what's happening within the Natural Resource Fund or the Healthcare Access Fund. All that information is included in the financial statements, and we audit that information so that it can be relied on by the bond rating agencies so that the state can sell debt. But I think more important, it becomes a treasure trove of information for all of you to look and find answers to any of your financial questions. Secondly, we look at all of the federal programs that the state participates in. You'd be surprised to see that that the state of Minnesota participates in over 400 federal programs, and we have federal expenditures that are about $15 billion per year. My team is responsible for giving an audit opinion on the expenditures for those federal programs. That is what you will find in the federal program financial report. So you can see all 400 programs, the expenditures of those programs. But along with looking at expenditures, we're required by the federal government to look at the internal controls over those programs to make sure that the agencies have strong fiscal controls. And in addition, we're responsible for looking at major compliance features in those programs as well. So when we go and do audit work in a program, it's not just looking at the numbers and are the numbers fairly presented. We're looking to make sure that that eligible people got the money, that got money as part of the requirements of that program as well. Some other types of required work on a quarterly basis, we've been doing work at the Metropolitan Council looking at their transit financial activities. We do work on health care programs. That is in the OLA statute that we're required to look at health care programs. Interestingly, if that was not required in law, it's an area that I think we should do anyway. I think one of the things that's interesting is, you know, I mentioned the 400 programs in the state of Minnesota's financial report. When you look at those 400 programs, there's a lot of programs on that list that I consider small programs. They have, you know, tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars of expenditures per year. And there's also a lot of programs on that list that are medium-sized programs that maybe have $1 to $10 million in expenditures each year. And then there's large federal programs such as highway transportation aids, where they get up into the hundreds of millions or in the upper hundreds of millions of dollars each year. But there is one program that stands out as an anomaly, and that is medical assistance. And that program has nearly $7 billion in federal expenditures, and there's a state match as well, bringing the total expenditures for that program nearly $14 billion per year. It's important for the OLA to spend a lot of time looking at the health care eligibility in those health care programs, because that one program is individually significant on the state's overall budget. And then finally, recently, we have a mandate from the legislature to do work on MNLARS. And when the legislature gave the Department of Public Safety an additional pool of money for MNLARS, they also put some stipulations on that money, both on the agencies and on the Legislative Auditor's Office. So along with getting the money, the Department of Public Safety, along with Minnesota IT Services, has to produce quarterly reports and present that information to the MNLARS Steering Committee. OLA also has a requirement in law to look at those reports to make sure that accurate information is being produced to the for the legislature, as well as looking at other broader IT concepts as well. So we have the authority to go in and look at how well the technology is being designed. We also have authority in law to look at the fiscal resources that are set aside for both the project and for the ongoing operation of the system. So it's just a sampling of some of the required work that we do. On the discretionary audit side, one of the things that's probably most pertinent today is that the topics that are selected for the discretionary audits are selected by the Legislative Auditor's Office. However, we make that decision with broad input from policymakers. So throughout the year, we get tips and suggestions. My team has a running list of all the potential audit topics that we put together. And members of the Audit Commission get a special note. Representative Klom may remember that, but we ask members of the Commission in particular that we're going to be looking at our upcoming round of discretionary audits, do you have any hot-button issues that you'd like us to take a look at to put on the potential list? When we look at those audits, we assess fiscal controls. We also look at internal compliance. an example, just to make it real for you today, is we recently issued a report on the Department of Management and Budget, and we looked at shared business system cost management. We thought looking at IT funding was an important topic, particularly given the issues that we had with Minlars. But what we did in that report is we tried to answer the questions. What does it cost to run the shared business systems that states use? And we found that collectively, since the state put in SWIFT and the other shared business systems, we've put about $400 million into those shared business systems. So the OLA, we took a look at how the costing was done for those systems, and we wanted to make sure, does the agency have a long-range plan for those systems? And we made some really important recommendations in that report. First of all, we found that the Department of Management and Budget didn't have long-range cost models for their shared business system. And we recommended that they come out and they work and they put some costing models together. And we also found that they didn't have appropriate and reliable funding models to pay for those systems on an ongoing basis. So we made recommendations once again to the agency to work with their oversight committee, and that will be you, to figure out ways to put in place reliable funding models for their systems. And then we made recommendations for a recommendation for the legislature as well. We recommended that the legislature, before they appropriate money for major computer systems, that they also make sure that there's a long-term funding model in place. So we know that when we build major IT systems, that there's long-term costs that are affiliated with that. We should have a long-range plan that's in place before we appropriate money for systems so that we really understand what we're getting into when we start putting money down for development costs. And then finally, we have a very small team. We only have two individuals today, but one of the goals that we have in the Financial Audit Division, many of you may know that I formerly came as a commissioner and our state's chief information security officer. One of the things that I think is really important is to try and fill the void that's out there today in the legislature with IT. IT is very complex, and I don't think the legislature gets good information today about IT costs, about IT projects, and this is an area where I think the Legislative Auditor's Office is well poised to help the legislature get independent assessments of what's going on with major system development projects, not just Minlars, but the other ones that are in play as well. Also looking at cybersecurity controls and helping members of the legislature understand what is our cybersecurity posture, how well are we doing. And then finally, just looking at the broad IT infrastructure that the state has in place, particularly as we're making major moves such as moving out of data centers and moving into vendor-hosted space. There's a major project underway, for example, to move out of state data centers and move a lot of the state's computing load into Amazon Web Services today. So those are some of the kind of things that I think would be good for our office to get into to help provide the legislature with some information to fulfill its fiduciary duties. So, Mr. Chair and members, with that said, I'd like to turn the mic over to my colleague, Ms. Judy Randall, for the Program Evaluation Division.
Please introduce yourself for the tape and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Judy Randall, and I'm the Deputy Legislative Auditor for OLA's Program Evaluation Division. I'm just going to do a high level of kind of what we do, how we do it, and how our topics are selected, because that's a really important part of our process where the legislature and you individually are all involved. So first, we have about 15 staff. They are all subject matter generalists. So we don't have an expert in education, an expert in human services. Instead, we are kind of a research method experts. Staff are made up of folks who have masters in public policy, PhDs in political science, experts in statistics. So we're all kind of researchers. And being a subject matter generalist, I think, really helps us because we come into a subject area or topic and we don't know anything about it. First of all, we have no skin in the game. We have no idea of how things should go. And we go in there and we ask kind of all those dumb questions, you know, of, well, why do you do it this way? And, you know, sometimes we get the answer, well, this is how we've always done it. But sometimes people say, yeah, we shouldn't be doing it this way. This is, you know, here are some ideas. And so by us kind of asking those really basic questions, because we're not subject matter experts, I think we can really kind of get to some good ideas and good improvements quickly. Our staff produce about 5 to 7 program evaluations annually. Here's the list of the program evaluations that we produced last year. And I just wanted to put this list up because I think it shows the breadth of topics that we cover. As Mr. Nobles covered earlier in this presentation, we have really broad jurisdiction. And so the topics that we evaluate cover that range as well. So in a given year, you can see last year we looked at the Board of Animal Health's oversight of deer and elk farms, early childhood programs, the Guardians Ad Litem program, Minnesota Investment Fund, which is an economic development program, the Office of Health Facility Complaints, which is that office in the Department of Health that receives complaints about nursing home care and care for vulnerable adults, and voter registration. So again, a really broad range of topics. And I want to talk a little bit about how we do these evaluations, because, you know, I said, okay, well, we don't know anything really about these subject matters when we start. And because we are researchers, we basically employ every research, every research method that we can. So certainly we use our access to data of all classifications to get data, to talk to people, to conduct surveys. Of course, we read the law and we read the literature and we read court opinions. But some of the things that I think make the biggest difference in what we do is we get out and we talk to the people who are affected by these programs. So when we did the evaluation of the Office of Health Facility Complaints, not only did we talk with all the investigators and survey all the program staff, but we actually accompanied the investigators on investigations into nursing homes, talked to residents, surveyed the facility, kind of just shadowed the investigator. And that's an example of us being able to use our access to data of all classifications and the ability to classify things ourselves as confidential to give us insight into these topics that we otherwise wouldn't. Another example is several years ago we did an evaluation of alternative learning facilities. And on that topic, not only did we survey students who attend those alternative learning programs, but we actually went to those schools. We did focus groups with the teachers. We did focus groups with the students. So, again, we're really trying to get a deep and broad understanding of not just the program data, but how these programs affect people who are receiving services from them or delivering the services in them, and then hearing from them about suggestions for how to improve things. I do want to talk about how we get our topics, because as Mr. Boozy said, it's a little different between the Financial Audit Division and the Program Evaluation Division. The Program Evaluation Division can only evaluate topics that are selected by the Legislative Audit Commission. And again, those are those 12 members that Mr. Nobles put up on the slide earlier. But there's a whole process that goes into it, including a lot of input from you all. So I wanted to make sure we cover that, because we're going to be coming pretty soon and asking you for suggestions for topics for evaluation for the coming year. So the first thing is people suggest topics. You all suggest topics, but we also get topic suggestions from general public. We've gotten topics suggested from commissioners who say we should look at things within their programs. Stakeholder groups, people do anonymous suggestions. Staff make suggestions based on things we see when conducting financial audits or other program evaluations. That list is kind of always running, and I'm receiving topic suggestions all year long, but we do kind of a big push for topic suggestions starting in February. So be on the lookout. There'll be a yellow sheet of paper that's kind of a make your suggestions to us request. And remember, anything that receives state funding is fair game. So if you have questions about the way a program is being run or managed, or do you think things could be done better and you want us to take a look at it, write it on that yellow sheet and we'll put it on the list. Now, we do end up getting between 100 and 130 different topics that are suggested for us to evaluate in a given year. And if you recall, I said we ultimately evaluate 5 to 7 in a given year. So what I always tell agencies when we go in is, you know, congratulations, you won the lottery. You're one of 5 or 6 out of the 100-plus that got selected. So how do we narrow it down? So we have that master list of 100-plus topics. And the Audit Commission has a subcommittee focused on evaluation, program evaluation, and they narrow that list down. And that's kind of the biggest cut. So we go from this 100-plus list to about 15 that we call our semifinalists. And then with those semifinalists, we have staff develop just some background information. Can we do this topic? Are there data available? What are the questions? Where can we add value? But at the same time, we are surveying all legislators to gauge interest in those topics. Because ultimately, if you recall back to our mission, part of what we want to do is produce reports that are accurate, objective, timely, and useful. And useful means it's something that you all are interested in learning more about. So the survey ends up being one of the most important pieces the Audit Commission uses when they ultimately select their final topic. And so the Commission looks at the information we've provided, and then they also look at the survey responses, and then they do select the topics. Now, they have criteria that they use when they're judging which topics they think would make the most sense for us to use our resources on to evaluate, and just to real quickly run through them. So the first is this a program that the state controls, and how much money does the state spend on it? Now, we do sometimes look at projects or programs that don't spend a ton of state resources, but certainly if there's a lot of state resources involved, that makes it a more appealing topic to the Audit Commission. State control, is it a state program? If it's a federal program, well, it won't really matter what recommendations we make. We can't, you know, you all can't make changes to that, and so then maybe that's not the best place for our resources to focus on. Impact is kind of an interesting one because it can be interpreted a couple different ways. One would be, does it affect a lot of people? So I think of the early childhood programs evaluation. Affects a lot of people across the whole state. Or looking at clean water fund outcomes, right? We all care about clean water. That affects everybody. Big impact. Sometimes, though, the impact may be on fewer people, but maybe it affects them really deeply. And for that one, I think of the Office of Health Facility Complaints, the one related to, you know, the agency in state government that receives complaints about how vulnerable adults are receiving care. May not affect as many people as clean water, but, man, it affects those vulnerable adults and their families really deeply. So, again, a lot of impact, a different type of impact, but significant impact nonetheless. Timeliness is a question of how long has this program been around? Is there information that's going to exist for us to be able to evaluate it? Did it just change? And so everything we're going to be, all the data that we have would be about a, frankly, a different form of the program. Did we just look at this program a year or two ago and maybe we need to give them some time to make changes before we evaluate again? So those are the types of things the Audit Commission considers under timeliness. Feasibility is, frankly, is it something that we can do? Do data exist? Are the questions that are asked something that we can do looking at data, talking to people, conducting surveys, all of those research methods that we use? And then finally, balance is something the Audit Commission just looks at when they're picking their final slate of topics. They don't want all five or six of our program evaluations to be about education. You know, we do create a little bit of a burden when we do an evaluation on a program. That state agency has to provide information to us. They need to be available. It's not really fair if, you know, everybody is focused if we do six education programs. So the Audit Commission tries to spread the love a little bit under balance. But these are all really important criteria, and it's something that they're all things that the Audit Commission considers. In addition, I will just say again, your responses to the survey. They really weigh that probably more than any of the other aspects of topic selection, although perhaps Representative Quam would like to speak to that. I don't know. He can speak on that if you want, Mr. Chair. But with that, I'll end the overview of the Program Evaluation Division, and I think that brings us to the end of our prepared comments. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Ms. Randall. I have one question, then I got open up for questions. I got some people on the list here. When we get these audit evaluations, there's always recommendations of what we can do to fix and make things better. How often do we follow those as the legislature, and how often do we ignore them and just put them on the shelf and let them collect dust? Because I've heard that as a complaint from many legislators in the past.
Mr. Chair and members, I thank you for the question. First, I would say the legislature always pays attention to our reports. And I think that the reports always contribute to the conversation. And ultimately, I think that's their biggest value. You know, sometimes we are doing reports on things that already get a lot of attention, and we just kind of contribute more to that. And sometimes it shines a spotlight on an area of state government that maybe hasn't risen to the collective consciousness yet. You know, I don't, Mr. Nobles may want to jump in as well. I don't know that there's a, you know, there's not a requirement that our recommendations become law. We do our work based on independent judgment of the facts. you all do your work with a lot of other things you're considering, right? So I'm not sure that a scorecard is the right way to judge either our work or your response to our work. I think if there's a conversation around it and dialogue and debate, I think it's been a success. I will just note, before Mr. Nobles jumps in, that state agencies take our recommendations very seriously. We do make recommendations to the legislature for changes in law, and we also make recommendations to agencies, and I think agencies have a good response. Finally, I'll just say I have worked on evaluations where every recommendation became law, and I have worked on evaluations that received one or two hearings. I'm going to choose to believe that both of those reports are valuable, perhaps some in less visible ways.
Mr. Chairman, members, one of the things that I really impress upon the staff at the Office of Legislative Auditor is that we work in an environment where we have a role to play, where, as Ms. Randall said, we go off and do research. And we certainly try to find out, and we do find out, how these programs are being administered, how they affect people. But you represent those people. You are elected. We're not. And we have deep respect for the fact that you have an election certificate, that you come here representing your constituents, their interests, and their interests are wide and varied. And so when we make a recommendation, it's going to impact you and your constituents in some way. And you're going to see those things in a somewhat different way, depending on who you represent and what their interests are. Ms. Randall, for example, worked some years ago on something called Integration Revenue. It's an interesting report. We had a lot of criticism of that program. Not only the way the money was handed out, the formula was driven, but also the way the money was used. And so we made recommendations to change the formula and for how the money was going to be used. Changing the formula meant that some of your districts would get more and some would get less. So the ones that were going to get more thought that was a great recommendation. Those of you who thought your districts and knew your districts would get less, not so much. But you agonized in a way, because I think you saw the facts and you agreed with the facts. But the facts are one thing. The impact that it will have on your people, your districts, your school districts, is another. And so those that were already getting a lot of money wanted to keep it. There are sometimes winners and losers, and you have to decide that. We can't. Ultimately, the legislature worked on that for many years, had many task forces after we issued our report, and made some changes. But one of the ways we stay here, pretty enthusiastic, frankly, about our role and our work, is that we have a chance to have some impact. But ultimately, we respect the fact that you make the decisions. So when you make a decision that is contrary to the great idea we delivered, we say, God love America, that's democracy.
Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Honorable Nobles, I understand your office recently felt compelled to use your subpoena authority to compel a state agency to release information on your office related to an investigation your office is conducting. Can you describe the situation, including the background, on how your office learned of the allegation of the alleged release of the nonprofit data?
Yes. Mr. Nobles. Mr. Chairman and members, thank you for that question. Just a very quick background. The data breach, and we do call it a breach, involved a transfer of driver's license data through MNLARS. It's a bulk data transfer. The state basically is authorized to sell data to various data gathering organizations. It's a big money business, and there are a lot of organizations that want that data that we collect, that we compel citizens to give us, and they use it for all kinds of purposes, including marketing, but other purposes as well. We actually, under law, have been required to audit that system of bulk data sales, and we are starting that this year. We had a source that told us, an anonymous confidential source that told us that in the Menlar system, they had not established a filter to keep the private data from being sold. You, as a person who goes down and fills out the information you have to give, are given the opportunity to say, I don't want my data sold. And there are thousands of people who do that. And I might say they don't offer that to they, the state does not initiate offering you that option. You have to ask for it. But if you ask for it and you say, I want my data to remain private, we think the state ought to honor that because that's your home address. What we were told by a source is that a significant number of people's private data was not filtered out and it was sold. That was not reported to us. Agencies are required under law to report to the legislative auditor anytime there is an unauthorized disclosure of private data. They did not do that, the Department of Public Safety. I had a source come to me and tell me that had occurred. Therefore, I sent a letter to the Commissioner of Public Safety saying, I have information that indicates that there has been a data breach through the bulk data sales system. And I want information about that. I gave the commissioner, as I recall, 2 weeks to provide that information. We did not receive it. We made a contact back to the department, and they would not give us a date certain by which we would get it. So I issued a subpoena for all of that information to be provided, and we have that information now, and we have opened an investigation on what occurred.
Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to add on to the question that you had asked them, one of the more recent ones was the Board of Teaching. And there were, I think, a few dozen lawsuits about people who had taught in other states being denied licensure. They were told they had to student teach, et cetera, et cetera. The audit had several recommendations, and that fueled the restructuring of the Board of Teachers and licensure in the state of Minnesota by the legislature. Now, we've got many new members on this committee, and frankly, if something comes up and you think, well, I'd like to know more, or we should look at that, write it down and get it ready for that list of suggestions, because the legislative auditor augments and also gives more in-depth view, because it's our duty to oversee, and that's a good tool for overseeing. But I do understand that there, for the auditor, that there is additional work from the audit on the voter registration, and I was wondering when that might be done. Plus, if you could give us an idea of the recent audits, which ones might be good for this committee to maybe get a look at, especially for members that weren't around when those audits went through.
Mr. Nobles, and also the new members, if you look online, you can go back and see the previous audits, so it may be something you're curious about that the auditor might have done in previous years, you know, and so you can go back and pull those audits off online or request a copy of it, and they'll get it to you. So, Mr. Nobles.
Mr. Chair, I think I'm going to ask my colleagues, because I know that they have some things to offer, and if I think of something that they don't say, I'll offer it to.
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, excuse me, thank you for the question. Related to the evaluation on voter registration, the team that worked on that is now just finishing up this round of evaluations that the Audit Commission approved last session, and the key person is about to start on the follow-up work. We already requested some of the data. Short answer is I'm hoping within a month that we'll have some follow-up information for you on related to the voter registration evaluation. And just for members more generally, I just want to explain that so the Audit Commission directs us to conduct evaluations, and that's the only sphere that we can do work on. But we also then have the authority in law to conduct follow-up work related to evaluations that we have done. So The work Representative Quam is asking about is something he had asked us to do some follow-up work on related to that voter registration evaluation from last year. And so then what we try to do is slot it in as best as we can amidst our evaluation schedule, which is pretty full. So it is the top thing on my list, actually, at my desk, and so it has not fallen off our radar screen. Regarding the other evaluations that that we did, I'll just look at last year and then that are forthcoming, that would be relevant, I think, in particular for this committee. I'll note that, so forthcoming, we're going to be releasing in a couple weeks an evaluation on the State Arts Board grant administration. So I think that might be something that this committee is interested in. That will also be something that probably the Legacy Committee is interested in. And then we are also doing a broad evaluation of MNIT, the Office of Minnesota IT Services. This is separate from our work on MNLARS, which we have been doing a lot of, but this is really a broad look at MNIT, how it's organized, how the consolidation of IT services has gone since the legislature passed that consolidation law in 2011. And so those are, I'd say, are the top two that are coming out for this committee. And then looking back at last year, I would say the voter registration evaluation is probably the other one that's most relevant to this committee. But certainly we have all of our evaluations on our website. They're organized by subject area as well. So if there's a certain subject area you're interested in, our evaluation reports, in addition to making findings and recommendations, often provide a really good background on a certain subject area and provide some context, and we often consider them kind of a primer for folks to learn about an area. So I would encourage you to use them as that type of resource as well.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to augment that, members, MNSURE and MNLARS and other IT things have been big topics, this committee and others. And actually, one of our testifiers, I believe, was with the auditor's office, went to work with MNIT, and is now back with the auditor's office. So this group is very familiar with that, and I think is a great resource.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure to which testifier, but I know you said that you audit the Comprehensive Annual Financial Report. And I'm used to business audits that are prepared relative to the Financial Accounting Standards Board. And I realize there's a difference for governance and a government, but and I don't get too far in the weeds, but my concern is that the financial, the CAFRA, probably isn't prepared with the same information as would be a private sector audit that a publicly traded or even the nonprofits use, where you would have a management letter and internal controls evaluation as part of that report. So if you're auditing the CAFRA and looking for the accuracy of what's in that report, but there aren't things like management letter or internal controls, first of all, is that a fair assumption of what's going on relative to the CAFRA?
Whoever wants to.
Mr. Chair, committee members, no, that is not fair.
Okay.
In fact, when you look at the auditing or at the accounting principles that apply to the private sector organizations, generally accepted accounting principles also apply to government entities. So that's basically the rule book that's used to put financial statements together. But on top of generally accepted accounting principles, there's an extra layer that goes on top of that for government. So there's government-specific accounting principles that we must comply with as well when financial statements are put together. So all of the things that you see as part of the rigor that goes into preparing financial statements for a private sector entity also go into preparing financial statements for a government. And that includes a letter on internal control. It includes a management letter. So if you look at our CAFR, not only is the audit opinion in there that I signed, but you also see a management letter from Commissioner Myron Franz that talks about the changes in financial position of the organization. So they are very, very parallel. But in fact, you have even more rigor on top of a government audit, especially something as complicated as a state government.
Mr. Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifier, so thank you for the clarification. My question is then, why wouldn't there have been something in the management letter or the internal controls saying that we had a $100 million project, MNLARS, that was not progressing as it should, and therefore corrective action should have been taken back maybe in 2011, 12, 13?
Mr. Boosie.
Mr. Chair, committee members, that's a good question. When you look at the state of Minnesota as a whole and the size of our entity, I'm not sure whether one project would have been significant enough from a financial perspective in order to raise to the level it would be in the management letter. I'll ask Commissioner Franz that, whether they actually had even explored that possibility. But when we looked at the financial statements, the accounting for the information and the funds, the fact that one project that was not doing as well as it should was not disclosed as part of the overall management discussion and analysis, I don't think that would have rose to the level where we would question that as something that would actually taint the readers who look at the financial statements. It's not to say that that's not a significant issue. And looking at the OLA, we're doing a lot of work on that project in a lot of different areas. But from the financial statement perspective, I'm not sure if that's necessarily the place where it needs to be.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just add, we have many places and tools for disclosure. And so we use the financial statements as one mechanism. But frankly, if there are issues that we think need to be disclosed, like the problems with MNLARS, we may choose other mechanisms. You certainly, Representative Vogel, might be looking for that in that big, thick book. But we would probably want to highlight it apart from that, just so that it gets more visibility. I have really worked hard, and I know Chris has over the years too, to get people to pay more attention to the financial statements. They're daunting. You read them, but I must say, they're daunting. But they are a treasure trove, as Mr. Boosie said, of data, as long as you can work your way through them. So what we would do with and have done with MNLARS and other things, MNSURE, that have not gone well, we find other mechanisms. The other thing I would say is, I'm not sure back at the time frame you referenced, we knew what a problem MNLARS would be. In fact, we sent a team over to look at, take a reading of MNLARS before it went live. And, you can look at those systems and you can see people with a lot of green lines saying things are going well. The consultants are saying everything's going well. We're going through the checklist. And so when we issued that report, I added one qualification. We will not know until it goes live if it will perform as advertised and as expected, and it didn't.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just one quick follow-up. My comment was not a criticism of what OLA is doing, because I love seeing the work that they do. I guess my comment is that I think as we look at the way we are auditing things, that we have to recognize that we're probably not delving into things quite as much as maybe even some of the smaller nonprofits that we're giving money to that are responsible for an audit that would have such a management report. So my comment is that I appreciate what they're doing. I didn't want to sound like a criticism, but I do think that we have some work to do when it comes to watching things as they're progressing rather than just looking back. Thank you.
And members, we scheduled this for a half hour, almost twice that now, but Representative Olson, if we can make it quickly, we got two more programs to look at.
Okay, thank you, Chair Nelson. My question was just around understanding a little bit more what falls in with the jurisdiction of what the commission gets to decide. I've heard that's around evaluations, and it sounds like special investigations and other things fall out of the purview of what the commission decides. So maybe, Mr. Nobles, if you could just share what decisions lie outside of the commission, and then who makes those decisions, and then I'll keep it all in one question here. And then budgetarily, have you seen a change in how much of the office budget is going to the evaluations component versus the special investigation component and other pieces outside the realm of the commission?
Mr. Chairman and members, I will move through that quickly. We have been doing more special reviews and investigations. I have, in fact, appointed a director of special investigations. It's one person, and I work on them a great deal myself. Our legal counsel also works on them. So there are more of them. I would say we're achieving those more by the fact that we've dedicated a couple of staff, but a lot of my time as well, to work on those. So I don't know if that fully answers your question. But the reason we do them and the authority under which we do them, again, I would remind you, they come on top of everything else that we've been directed to do. And one of the things I have committed to the Legislative Audit Commission is that I will not take resources that we have dedicated to doing the work that the commission wants us to do, that has directed us to do an investigation or a special review. That's why I get involved in those myself. The authority to do them is in the law. If you look at page 11 under the Financial Audit Division, there is a sentence near the end that says, the legislative auditor shall see that all provisions of law respecting the appropriate and economic use of public funds and other public resources are complied with, and may, as part of a financial audit or separately, investigate allegations of noncompliance. As to who decides, I decide. And so when there is an issue that comes up, like the allegations about fraud and use of money for terrorism related to CCAP, I make that decision that that is of high priority and that we will need to investigate that. Sometimes, the Legislative Audit Commission can direct us to do a special review or investigation. They have that authority. But I think for the sake of independence, the Legislative Audit Commission understands that if the legislative auditor, whomever that might be, sees an issue where public resources are being misused, there needs to be an independent authority able to say, we will look into that. And that's the way it's worked. And I think the Legislative Audit Commission and I see that as something that the legislative auditor should have the authority to do.
Representative Olson?
Just quick, Mr. Chair, thank you. That's helpful. And I think just as we go forward and have a chance to talk more about this, it would be helpful to understand a little bit more budgetarily about, you know, having that, what that looks like financially when you are seeing an increase in special investigations that you're deciding on versus what the legislator is directing around evaluations.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A really quick comment and then one question. And my comment is I use these reports a lot and mostly in the committees that I serve in. And if you're serving on a committee and subjects come up, I recommend you read them. They're very easy to read. You have to get past the short version and you have to read into the report because they are very gracious. And almost everyone will start out with, this entity has complied for the most part. But then they got to get into the evaluations, the conclusions, and the recommendations. And this is, I really appreciate this office because it's like a 20,000-foot view. Whether you like what they say or not, what they're doing is designed to make government run more efficient and honestly. And so I just appreciate these reports they give out. I have a whole drawer full of them. My question is, what have you looked into in the way of NGOs, and do you think that they get enough money to warrant legislative audit?
Mr. Chair, Representative Green, NGOs meaning nonprofit organizations.
Non-government agencies.
Right, yeah. And as I mentioned, they do receive a great deal of money. In fact, we did an evaluation. Ms. Randall was the manager of that evaluation of the relationship between nonprofit organizations and the state. That relationship is really defined legally through grants. And there are millions, tens of millions of dollars that flow to nonprofit organizations from the state in grants. And so, yes, we look at them, and sometimes we go even beyond what we see in the state's part of the grant agreement. But we will go into the nonprofit organization. We have that authority. We've done it, and we will do it if we see some issue that we need to examine. I would just quickly also say that we have a very heavy presence in a particular kind of nonprofit organization in this state, and those are the ones that deliver almost all of the health care that you pay for, and that those are managed care organizations. And so we have a special mandate to audit the money that they use, and that is billions of dollars.
Thank you. Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the auditing work that you've been done related to MNLARS and other MNIT work, have they been forthcoming with the information, or have you had to resort to your subpoena powers to obtain the information you need to conduct those audits?
Mr. Nobles.
Mr. Chair, members, with the exception of the subpoena I issued relative to the data breach recently on the bulk data, we have worked through issues with them. It hasn't always been easy. They haven't always been as forthcoming as we wanted, but we worked through those issues, and I did not issue a subpoena.
Thank you.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Mr. Nobles. Mr. Nobles, you facilitate a very unique but needful function of oversight for the work that this committee does. With that in mind, Mr. Chair, I just have one opening question and then a follow-up pursuant to the answer I get. The coordination between this committee and the work that you do is paramount to making sure that we uphold our fiduciary responsibility. Agencies typically do comply with their responsibility to be diligent about the monies that they are provided in their budgets and whatnot to your budget, but then to others. I'm just wondering, you, Representative Olson, mentioned the difference between investigative and oversight. Is it the function of government growing in other areas that requires us maybe to take a look at a little different look at what your functions are with regard to evaluations versus investigations? And I cite MNLARS, I cite DPS, I cite Minute, I cite MNsure as examples of responsibilities for oversight that maybe came too late. That should we have opened a channel of communication or a quasi-audit of benchmark achievement in large projects such as those that would have alerted both this committee and others to variances from progress made or assured of? And I'm just wondering if there is an involvement insertion point that you could identify where we don't get into investigations after the fact and we're more dealing with evaluations as a program is rolled out, to your point about we won't know if this works until we go live.
Mr. Hill.
Mr. Chairman, members, I think that's an excellent point and one we do ponder a lot, and that is, I mean, we are a post-audit organization. We tend to like, as Ms. Randall said, one of our criterion is timeliness, you know, and so normally we would say, let's give that program or that new software a year or two to function before we can make a judgment on whether or not it works or not, because there are going to be glitches and bugs. But I think, frankly, we have had such bad experience, and it's cost so much money, that I think this committee, other committees, and the Office of the Legislative Auditor really ought to talk about your point. Are there some points in the process where it would be appropriate and useful for us to insert ourselves with some of our IT expertise to make a judgment on whether or not this project is on track? And then we're going to have to talk with the executive branch about public disclosure of that information. And that is a problem. I mean, we are seeking information right now about some things. I don't know how far to go with this. We are seeking some information about where things are right now in terms of planning for the future that I'm not sure the executive branch wants to share publicly or, frankly, share with you at all. And we are going to try to be that mechanism. And we will be respectful of their need for some degree of privacy in their operations. But ultimately, when push comes to shove, it seems to me transparency and accountability ought to win the day, whether they're comfortable with it or not. I'm very much on the side of the legislature in terms of your representation of your clients, your constituents, and your need to know. And I think you need to know sooner on some things than you have been. And I think you need to know the raw truth, frankly, of exactly where things were with Menlars back 4 years ago, where they were with Minsure before it went live. And we probably could have told you some of those things. But we work under certain constraints of not disclosing information that is not public information, that is still classified as private. So that's a little bit vague, but I just think you raise a very good point. But I don't think this is just up to the Office of Legislative Auditor to do and decide. You, the legislature, need, I think, and excuse me for sounding like I'm lecturing you, you need to figure out what your committee structure is for really diving deep into these very expensive systems development projects. We can give you some information, but where is the jurisdiction and where does this fit? I mean, if DHS wants to develop a new system, are they at the DHS committee getting the money? Is it through Minute? Where are the points of transparency and accountability, and at what point can that information be made public? I think we're going to make this more real probably shortly, as we are looking at what is the plan for funding Menlars over the long term.
Mr. Chair, just a short follow-up to that. And sure. With
Representative Albright, and make it quick because I've got one more question, then we need to get to the next.
Absolutely. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Nobles, to your point, last year we enacted legislation that established the Legislative Budget Office. In my opinion, I think that speaks directly to the points that you've made about ameliorating for the benefit of the various committees information about the raw truth, about what things cost and where they're online. But to the extent that they remain independent, as we would hope, just like your organization, I think they can provide. But I share your sentiments about it should be a bipartisan effort to identify where things are going right, but also where things are going terribly wrong, and getting us back on track. So to that point, Mr. Nobles, I'm wondering if you'd be willing to share any comments about your thoughts on if it requires a subcommittee group to look at this, to your point about which committees would have jurisdiction if the LBO is part of that conversation. How can we strengthen their abilities? Because it is both on both sides of the aisle that would benefit from a strengthening of those characteristics, those capabilities, because the end result is, to your point, the constituents are better served regardless of the decision-making process that we come to, because there's more and greater transparency. That's what we're all looking for.
And specifically, and I'll be very quick, we have here, frankly, the best person you could have in the room for bridging this divide between the legislature and the executive branch on systems development. Mr. Boozy started his career in the OLA, and then he went over to the executive branch and was the chief information security officer for the state of Minnesota. He knows it from the inside, and I think one of the things that he has is a very high priority, because he has seen the need to build a bridge between the executive and legislative branch, and we're going to depend on him to help us do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hertzos, you'll be the last question if you make it quick.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. Mr. Nobles and staff, the Ways and Means Committee and the Government Finance Committee recently in the beginning weeks has gotten overviews from MME. And my question to you, sir, is as it relates to the discussions about the current federal shutdown, Minnesota receiving more than $1 billion a month in pass-through dollars. My question relates to separation of powers. Now, I understand the executive has control over the dollars within their specific budgets within that branch, but the rhetoric I've been hearing, and it doesn't seem to be any clarity, is the question of whether or not monies are going to be spent to fund shortfalls from the federal government. And the legislature is supposed to be that separation of power that appropriates money. And I have a concern that our legislative agenda may be at risk if the executive branch feels it has the authority to just go in and use reserve funds or cash accounts or in relationship to this projected surplus. So my question to you is, as a legislative auditor, are there safeguards in place to prevent my concern from happening, or is there some mechanism in which we, the legislature, need to put the executive on notice that these transfer of funds to fund shortfalls really require an action of the legislature?
Mr. Nobles, or
Mr. Chair and members, I think the best thing for me to say to do is take that very complex question back, do some research, and certainly you have legal staff here. I think that is even a question that could require an opinion from the Attorney General, but I do think it is something you should have independent legal advice on, and being part of the legislative branch, I would certainly be willing to try to participate in providing that to you. But I think also you have legal staff at House Research, nonpartisan staff, that can help you with that as well. But it raises a very good question. Thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Nobles, and thank you for the overview. Next we have Mr. Mandel with the Capital Area Architectural and Planning Board. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the tape, and hopefully we can get through this quicker. And
Chair. Paul Mandel, Executive Secretary for the Capital Area Architectural and Planning Board. You have in your packets our biennial report, and I'll just make a few comments and then open up questions. I do have to compliment Mr. Nobles. He started off by talking to you about how they were created in 1973, and I guess he was there then. Our board was created in 1967 when all these special districts were being created nationwide. We were created by the legislature to be answerable to the legislature, and in 1974 you added the zoning authority and changed the commission to a board. I have not been here since that time. I've been here since 1987. For 28 years I was the principal planner, and for the last four I was the executive secretary. The Capital Area Architecture and Planning Board was established, as I said, in 1967, a small non-cabinet planning and regulatory agency responsible for the architectural design and long-range planning for the Capital Area. The legislature sets our boundaries, and the board's responsibilities are found in Minnesota Statute 15B. The board's mission is twofold. First, to preserve and enhance the dignity, beauty, and architectural integrity of the Capital and the Capital Area's unique historic character, and secondly, to help plan and guide its future development by maintaining a flexible framework for its physical growth. The CAP Board consists of 12 members, chaired by the Lieutenant Governor, and is composed of four gubernatorial appointees, three mayoral appointees, and four legislators. Three architectural planning professionals advise the board. The staff serving the board consists of four employees, an administrative assistant, a planner, a principal planner, and myself as the executive secretary, the latter two being the only two full-time staff people. We have exclusive zoning jurisdiction and design and review over both the exclusive zoning jurisdiction and design review over both the state government complex and the surrounding commercial and residential neighborhoods within the 60 block area. We guide the planning and design with a comprehensive plan and with a zoning and design rules for the 60 block area surrounding the Capitol. As noted earlier, we are responsible for the beauty, dignity, and architectural integrity of the area. This stands in stark contrast to the normal zoning authority, which relates to safety, health, and life. We were created intentionally for this purpose so that the environment with which people serve here and the visitors that come here would enjoy the environment around the Capitol and the 60 blocks surrounding it. These two documents are currently in the process of a three-year-long rewrite. The Cap Board has updated our website, converting to the state's Tridian website using funds from the Odyssey Fund set aside in 2015. These funds also enabled us to electronically create a backup to our extensive historical files in response to our COOP planning. The independent board has responsibility to provide the legislature with review comments on any capital budget requests and proposals within the capital area, and has in the past often carried capital budget requests for the Capitol building. The board, along with the Minnesota Historical Society, also exercises control over the historic public spaces in the Capitol building, including the artwork in those spaces. Our operating budget is $350,000 per year. The board's current base budget breaks down as follows: salary and benefits 76%, rent 11%, land and IT charges 4%, and other business operations approximately 9%. Since 2000, the Cap Board's operating budget has varied only from a low in 2003 of $262,000 per year to a high in 2007 and 8 of $427,000 and $373,000, which at that time included a one-time allocation of $65,000 to complete the comprehensive plan and zoning and design rules for the Capitol area. This year, due to lack of additional funds, that work is being done in-house but over a longer time period. Between 2003 and 2007, due to budget cuts statewide, the board was forced to operate on a four-day work week with reduced staffing. I will also mention that in 2011, the Cap Board was one of about 12 to 15 boards and commissions that went through the full review of the then Sunset Commission, which ceased to exist the year after they did that review. Also, in 2014, we had a limited audit by the legislative auditor and was found to not merit a full audit at that time. The Cap Board has always been proactive in achieving efficiencies as a budget. Back in the 90s, we relocated into the administration building, where savings were achieved by sharing space, equipment, land connections, IT support, and purchasing programs. Since 2014, we have also had budgeting assistance from the Financial Management and Reporting Division of Department Administration through the SMART team. In conclusion, our staff works to ensure that the quality of services provided to the public and other state bodies is of our highest quality. Thank you.
Representative Claiborne, you have a question.
I do. Mr. Chair, Mr. Mandel, members, I just have a few quick questions regarding basically the Sears store site. I understand that the Sears property falls within the jurisdiction of the Cap Board, and I'm wondering, what will your authority be over the actual development of that property? And as we think about that, I'm kind of thinking about the process, you know, whereby will the Cap Board be working with the city to determine how that property is going to be developed? And does the board have the authority as to the type of development? Is it going to be commercial, residential, open space? And then also, would you have the veto authority as to that ultimate plan?
Mr. Mandel.
Mr. Chair, members. The Cap Board reviewed back when Sears wasn't closing and was just looking to, back in 2011, they approached us. They had formed a subsidiary called Seritage, which was doing the marketing for 10 of their most prime redevelopment sites nationwide. In 2013, the board gave preliminary concept approval to a design concept for redevelopment of the entire site with the Sears staying in place. It included, and because our zoning does cover the entire 17-acre site, it's all zoned mixed use, and it is governed by our height restrictions, which means that nothing can be taller than the cornice of the Capitol. At that time, it included high-density residential on the south end, where the state currently has state parking leases of about 6 to 7 stories, which is our maximum height. It had commercial, retail, restaurants, the Sears, and structured parking to take care of all the parking that they would generate. Since that time, they've been out marketing Since that time, Sears is now closed, and Seritage owns the entire site, including the property that Sears is on. We do have complete authority over what goes there, and part of our work now started in 2017 and will continue for another year or so until the end of probably 2019, early 2020, is developing this new comprehensive plan. And right now we have, in fact, tomorrow afternoon our board is meeting for the second time to review what we call Chapter 7A of the comp plan, which is serving as a set of design guidelines. It's approximately 58 pages that sets out the parameters and how that entire site can be developed with regard to height, setback, green space, the street grid being restored, the mixed use nature of the mixed use, how the parking is handled, as well as architectural design. And we do have to, the board does have to approve every bit of that. And part of, because of the technology today, we're also incorporating things like mobility hubs and technology for telecommuting, or as well as making use of the Green Line that now has a station in the nearby area. So we will be asking them to show us how they're reducing the normal parking load that might occur with this kind of development, mm-hmm. and showing how they would be using either operational programs or capital programs to encourage people not to park or not to take cars all the time, but to use the transit systems.
Ms. Claiborne.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Mandel, members, I'm wondering how are you ensuring that the other property owners around the development will be, have their voices heard?
Sure. Madam Chair, Mr. Mandel. Members, we've already held, this chapter has been in development for the past year, and we've reached out to over 21 stakeholders, from the district councils to the neighborhood organizations, the block clubs, and the other main institutions such as the college, the hospitals, et cetera, to see that we can guarantee, first of all, that they're involved in the rewrite of this document, but secondly, that we can look at hopefully a shared parking solution for the entire district. The state has approximately 6,000 spaces that they maintain for a workforce of 8,500, and we want the state and others to participate in getting a better parking solution, because every time they build a new building, they're taking up a state surface lot, and then they're also generating additional parking. So it's a net gain, not a gross gain. We have also been working intimately with the City of St. Paul, with Department of Transportation, because they are looking at rethinking I-94 and are looking at some redesign, yeah. for the I-94 corridor. Our board has held three meetings looking at this material. We're incorporating the final changes in what we're proposing to the board tomorrow. And then that material it's not the force of law, because a comp plan isn't complete yet, but it will be absorbed into the final comp plan, which would be then go through, the zoning code goes through Administrative Procedures Act, which is an extensive, lengthy process of numerous months with administrative hearings, et cetera. But we'll continue to be involved with the 21 stakeholders that we've identified, including the district councils, taking comment. And by statute, deed and state arts board also have to comment on our comp plan. Usually the response is, what are we supposed to do with this? Because they get this document and they have no idea what they're supposed to do, but that's the way the statute is written.
Representative Cleaver.
Thank you.
One last question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Mr. Mandel, so when we're thinking about the overall timeline, what is your anticipated timeline for the finished comprehensive plan and then for shovel-ready finished?
Mr. Mandel.
Mr. Chair, members, the comprehensive plan, we have a planner that's been hired on a part-time basis through the end of 2019 right now, fiscal year 19. Fiscal year 20. So by that time, we hope to have the entire comprehensive plan either finished in draft form and doing the final review, or done completely. We have been talking with Seritage. We have asked them to hold off on they've been shopping out what they have on drawings right now. Now, we've seen it. The city has seen it. Several other official bodies have seen it. It has not gone public, and we've asked them to respect our process and to wait until the design framework itself has been fully adopted by the board, and then to use that to make any refinements before they go public with the document. So we anticipate that within the next 2 or 3 months, we would have what will probably hit all the newspapers with the full spread, just like you saw with the Ford plant redevelopment and such. And then we'll be in discussions with them through architectural advisors, with board members, with the city, with people like the stormwater for the demolition and handling of the site, there's hazardous materials, all the different bodies, the health department, everyone else. And I anticipate, I know they have several clients that are itching to get in, so I would anticipate that within the year we have something either under construction, and it would be, we know it will be a phased development for sure, but they have several clients that are itching to get in, so I anticipate that within the year we'll see something being built. Whether the Sears is demolished before or after that time period, I don't know.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And on Principle 6, the word throughout, is that macro or micro? Is that general or down to each building or facility? Principle 6 is land use diversity throughout the capital area.
Yes. Mr. Chair.
Mr. Mandel.
Members. We're looking at within buildings and throughout the district. So we are looking at everything from affordable housing, if it can be done within each building. We have right now a on the north side of the Bethesda property, we have a property that it's an old vacant medical office building attached to a parking ramp that was that's owned by Krause Anderson, and they have been approved for demolishing the building and putting in a 96 unit micro apartment building. It'll have a few one bedrooms, but we're talking living quarters that are everything from 300 to 600 square feet for a full apartment. So that is considered by the city to be affordable because of the size. We anticipate more of that because this is what supposedly the millennials love. They don't, they only come home to sleep and they entertain themselves out on the green line somewhere, and they work at work and they bike everywhere and they don't even need cars. So this is being built by Krause Anderson. There's another one that's already fully out on, called the Ray, out on Raymond. But we anticipate everything from affordable housing to upscale housing, because the obviously if the Sears gets redeveloped with commercial, it's gotta work. And Wright Street now is rather marginal.
Representative Quam, one last question.
Did that answer the question?
Mm-hmm. Well, members, that's we've passed our time a little bit here, and so thank you for coming, and thanks for your answers. And we'll have to have the small, the State Board of Investments back another day. Yes, we didn't get to them. So with that, the meeting's adjourned.